This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, January 17th. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Eve Zukoff and Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. And we'll speak with Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Federal officials have withdrawn a proposed rule that would have slowed ferries to Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, Provincetown, and beyond. CAI's Eve Zukoff has details and joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
First of all, why was this slowdown proposed?
Well, it was part of an effort to protect critically endangered right whales. We talk about them a lot on this program. And, you know, a big part of the reason why there are just about 370 of them left is because these animals are getting hit by boats. So the hope was to better protect them. Now, critics have challenged the efficacy of these rules locally, whether they really are in danger in the Vineyard Sound, Nantucket Sound, kind of this area. But, you know, that's kind of maybe why, part of why this was pulled. I will say that the proposal wouldn't just apply to ferries, though, nor would it apply only to our region. It would have required more boats to slow down in larger swaths of the ocean, basically. So boats 35 feet or longer would be required to travel no more than 10 knots, which is like about 10 miles per hour, during certain times of the year in Vineyard Sound and Nantucket Sound, among other areas on the East Coast. Basically, the stretch was like Cape Cod Bay to North Carolina.
A big, long stretch of the East Coast.
Huge.
So this week, NOAA, which is the federal agency that oversees this, they withdrew the proposal. Why did that happen? What do we know about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was months of criticism from people who said that the proposal would have, in effect, reduced the amount of trips. You know, I'll talk about the local criticism here. The amount of trips that the Steamship Authority could provide to the islands, which is, you know, vital for emergency response and economic development. Nantucket folks told me that the fast ferry service would be eliminated in the off season because of this, and the slow ferry service would go from 3 trips a day to 2 trips a day, and it would go from 2 hours and 10 minutes to about 3 hours one way. The result of kind of all of that, you know, one analysis from UMass, the Donahue Institute, found that the loss of trips would translate into an 11% loss to Nantucket's economy. To the Vineyard, you know, the proposed rule would cut around 14% of ferry trips across Vineyard Sound. I talked about kind of also the more social, emotional side of this. So Brooke Moore, on the chair of the Nantucket Select Board, told me that there would be consequences to the workforce, to kids who travel on and off island for youth sports every day, for locals who travel on and off island for medical care. You know, the criticisms were ranging.
So a lot of concern locally. But as you said, this was a much wider proposal to cover far down the East Coast. I was surprised by one of the things you reported, which was that NOAA says that they got 90,000 responses from the public about this proposed rules, most of whom at least were asking for more engagement on this.
Yeah, a lot of those comments were from, you know, think about all of the people who have a stake in marine industries, all of the shipping companies. I think they were leaning incredibly hard on this, and there are lots of other folks too.
So this week, NOAA withdrew this proposal. Explain a little bit more about some of the reactions that you've heard to this.
Yeah, I mean, again, locally, Moore told me that she did a happy dance. after the story came out, I got an email from the National Marine Manufacturers Association. They sent me a statement that calls this a huge step forward. But this was a major disappointment for right whale experts, who say that research shows the proposed speed rule would have protected right whales. One quote from the New England Aquarium, a woman named Jessica Redfern, she said, failing to implement stronger vessel strike protection measures puts these animals at further risk of extinction. So that was kind of the big takeaway from conservation groups.
I want to switch gears here and talk about some more news, wider-ranging news here. Federal officials reported that 2024 was the third hottest year on record for Massachusetts, and the hottest year on record for the rest of the globe. Talk about what these rising temperatures could mean locally. You looked into this.
Yeah, I mean, our region can expect a lot. Intense warming is likely to fuel drought, wildfire, flooding, ocean acidification, harmful algae blooms, sea level rise, kind of these things that we report on piecemeal every single week. And then, you know, the ocean warming up, partially because it's absorbing a lot of that heat, there's so many consequences that come from our ocean warming. So one thing that I talked about with Woodwell Climate Research Center scientist Jennifer Francis is that warmer water means more moisture that gets evaporated into the air. We're actually already seeing that, a 4 to 5% increase in water vapor in the atmosphere. And locally, that water vapor is the energy that storms feed off of. So when a storm does come along, it can tap into that fuel, become stronger, last longer, just generally be more intense. And that's scary. That's how we get some major hurricanes, major nor'easters, that kind of thing.
How about impacts to local species?
Yeah, there are so many important local species that are migrating out of the area, while more southern species are migrating into local waters. So, you know, on the out, people obviously know cod, a lot of the groundfish species like haddock, flounder, those are pretty depleted right now. And then on the flip side, we've got newcomers, right? So that's like squid, more black sea bass. People are catching mahi-mahi, I hear, south of the Vineyard, which is surprising.
So more southern species kind of moving up into our waters as they warm. I want to talk here also about the fact that your beat right here at the station is to cover stories about the environment, mostly with this local angle. I want to ask you about the political change that's coming. Many people expect the Trump administration really to undermine current efforts to fight climate change. On Monday is the inauguration. Talk a little bit about what covering the environment could look like under the next Trump term.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many environmental issues that kind of go into this big questionable place. You know, decisions are made by people, and a whole new slate of people are going to be coming in and going out. So, like, one example here, I look at the head of the New England's Environmental Protection Agency. This guy is about to lose his job. That's David Cash. He's been like a lifetime environmental policy wonk. And under his leadership, the proposed machine gun range for Joint Base Cape Cod was scrutinized, and a report found that it could contaminate local drinking water. Now, without kind of that kind of leadership, I don't know if we get that report. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. But, you know, you can start to apply that kind of logic more broadly. So a new administration comes in with new priorities, has potential to impact, you know, PFAS in our drinking water and those regulations. Whales, you know, we're talking about that already. And of course, renewable energy. I'm sure you'll talk more about that. Trump has called clean energy a scam. So what that means for offshore wind locally and other renewable tech, we'll see.
Monday is the inauguration. Monday is also the 30th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It's officially a day of national service. What does that mean locally?
Yeah, well, a ton of organizations locally are offering opportunities, not just on Monday, but year-round. One event that came across my desk is a beach cleanup in Provincetown. The Center for Coastal Studies plans to host a community cleanup probably on Race Point, that's what it's looking like at the moment, from about 9 to noon. And then the trash gets sorted by type and color, and it gets tallied all up at the center's headquarters from 1 to 4. Folks who want to go to that can register on the Center for Coastal Studies website.
That is CAI's Eve Zirkoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. A much-anticipated state appeal process is about to get underway regarding the proposed discharge of radioactive water from the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us about this appeal process for Pilgrim. The plant owner, Holtec, wants to discharge about 1 million gallons of contaminated water into Cape Cod Bay. The state denied it a permit for this. What is the latest on the appeal by Holtec here?
Well, a pre-hearing conference was scheduled to happen Wednesday or Thursday of this week. Remember, this appeal is similar to a court case, even though it is not in court. It goes before a state appeals officer. I have not been able to get much information yet about how the conference went, but typically in court, it would be a meeting between lawyers and the judge, or in this case, the appeals officer, to iron out any kinds of questions that might be outstanding before the actual hearing begins. We also learned this week about the schedule for how the appeal is going to move forward. Once the pre-hearing work is done, which is happening now, it sets off a series of deadlines that are not specific dates, but they're like 30 days after X and 30 days and then another 30 days, depending on how things play out. So, and most of those are about filing testimony and they go in order. So first, Holtec has a deadline. That's the owner of Pilgrim. They have a deadline to file their testimony. After that, people in the community who have established standing to participate in this appeal, they have 30 days to file their testimony, followed by another 30 days for the state. That is the Department of Environmental Protection that is participating here for the state. And then after that, likely sometime in May, then Holtec has an opportunity to file a rebuttal to all the previous testimony in time for the actual hearing portion to begin in June. And they're estimating now that the hearing will probably last for 5 days.
At stake here is this water that could be discharged into Cape Cod Bay. We kind of want to remember that as we talk about all these appeals process. You reported that there are several specific issues to be decided in this appeal, but there are some issues that may or may not be included. We don't quite know what's being determined here. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, they're all kind of legal issues that go to the question of, whether or not there is any window in Massachusetts for something like this to be, as you said, discharged directly into Cape Cod Bay. And this, as a reminder, this is the water, almost 1 million gallons, that is basically in the nuclear reactor system from the nuclear power plant, Pilgrim. The plant has been closed since 2019. The water's no longer in use. And so now the decision is what to do with it. So there are four issues that will definitely be adjudicated here by the appeals officer. And those are some of the most fundamental elements of this whole situation. One, does the discharge constitute industrial waste under the Ocean Sanctuaries Act? Does it qualify for any kind of an exception as being existing discharge? Which that's a key point of argument because existing discharge is treated differently. But so far, it seems to be going toward the state saying no, it's not existing discharge because now it's not for an operating plant. The discharge is different. Another question is to be adjudicated is. There's another one about does it fall under an exception for an operating power plant? And then does federal law preempt the state on this issue? That's another question. So all of that is a mouthful. As I said, there are four other issues that may or may not actually get included. Just as an example, one has to do with whether a previous state settlement with Holtec is going to apply in this appeal process.
Okay, let's talk about offshore wind. You reported yesterday that two wind developers and the Massachusetts power companies didn't sign a power purchase agreement this week. They were scheduled to sign these agreements for two wind farms, New England Wind 1 and South Coast Wind. Tell us what happened here.
Yeah, so we've been following this right along. These two offshore wind developers were scheduled to sign contracts that set the pricing for how they would they'll be selling their offshore wind power to three Massachusetts electric companies. The projects are New England Wind 1 and South Coast Wind. And what happened yesterday is that the electric companies, along with the state who are working together, announced that no contract signing took place. And there was a letter issued by a lawyer for National Grid, one of the power companies. In that letter, they said the wind developers have not yet completed their contract negotiations there. So, kind of putting it on the wind developers, but without any explanation, really. They have set a new target date for signing these contracts, which is March 31st. And that, of course, what's the signing after the inauguration of President-elect Trump? So the power companies did not say that was the reason for this delay, but it certainly gives everyone here, and especially the developers, time to see what Trump might do before they sign on the dotted line for their pricing and their plans.
We know that Trump has pledged to stop offshore wind, and recently a Republican congressman from New Jersey, Jeff Van Drew, said that Trump had asked him to draft a possible executive order on offshore wind to stop all activity. We got another hint yesterday about how the new president might handle offshore wind. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this was a little bit different messaging. So, as you know, we're going through the Senate confirmation hearings for Donald Trump's nominees. And yesterday, there was a hearing for Secretary of the Interior. And Interior is the department that oversees the office that actually approves offshore wind farms. So President Trump's nominee for that is Doug Burgum. And under questioning, he said that he expects that projects that are already underway would continue, quote, if they make sense and they're already in law, unquote. And that was under some interesting questioning from Senator Angus King, who is an independent from Maine. And he was talking about the wind leases that have just taken place in the Gulf of Maine, which, as we know, includes the ones that are just off the Outer Cape here. And he was talking about the significance of those, how much power they would provide. And he asked Doug Burgum if he would commit to projects like that that are already underway. Now, there are a lot of different project statuses in terms of what counts as already underway. So that will be interesting because the Gulf of Maine projects are not as far along as the ones south of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket.
So we were just talking about the inauguration coming on Monday. I want to talk for a moment about how a new administration could really affect some of these big issues for us locally on wind. Of course, we have many people who have an economic stake in offshore wind and want it to continue for that reason, in addition to the climate benefits. But we also have residents in our region who are fighting offshore wind. What does it look like as we head into this new administration?
Right. Well, for me, after hearing yesterday's testimony there, one of the big questions is if there's a suspension of offshore wind, which projects might continue under that suspension and which not? But more directly on the economic side, certainly we have in our region some shoreside businesses and even fishermen who have been working for the offshore wind industry. Certainly, many fishermen are still against it. But for those who have found opportunities in wind, a suspension of that could put a damper on their income, depending on how long that suspension lasts. It could also affect career training programs for offshore wind, which we have several of in our region. Another thing that comes to mind, which is not directly about wind approvals, but the town of Nantucket has been advocating for tighter controls on how developers handle a problem. That is like the broken blade that we saw last summer. So, how would a new administration affect their advocacy? We don't know, but we will be looking for all of those local issues from whatever the Trump administration does with offshore wind.
How about the Cape Cod Bridges, the replacement project? We know that the state still, it hasn't received the bulk of the federal money it will need to build the Bourne Bridge.
Right. Yes, we have talked about that. So Sagamore is pretty much all set. Bourne really is looking for a multi-billion-dollar commitment from the federal government. And the state has been hoping that the Bourne Bridge could follow the Sagamore in construction within a year or two. If there's any kind of delay in the funding, there would be a delay in the construction. Supporters say that they think this project is a safety issue and that people working in the federal government know the Cape Cod bridges really are one need, almost one project, not two. So they're hoping that there will not be a problem with the funding for the Bourne Bridge, but that too remains to be seen.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We will take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on CAI. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. A tense moment at the Vineyard Haven ferry terminal on Wednesday night as a bomb threat unfolded. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette is here with the story. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
Ethan, the man at the center of this called the police himself, apparently, and several guns are involved. Take us through what we know about what happened.
Yeah, so around 9 o'clock on Wednesday night down at the Steamship Authority terminal, a man called Tisbury Police saying he found a gun. The man actually ended up being the guy that they arrested, David Caputo, Capato, I believe is how you pronounce it. He's 56. And then kind of a strange scene seemed to unfold, kind of according to Tisbury Police. So after officers got there, Mr. Capato then took the gun and put it in one of the kind of the blue USPS mailboxes outside near the terminal, then kind of rushed into his car, became uncooperative with officers, and they kind of got into this kind of tense, long negotiation to try and get him out of his car.
Apparently, at some point in that conversation, he said that he had explosives in the car, something that could detonate.
Yeah, he said he had explosives in the vehicle. He had more firearms in the vehicle. He told officers that he was a former New York City police officer who worked with ordnance disposal, so he knew what he was doing, according to Tisbury police. And so the state bomb squad was called in. There was kind of a 2-hour-long kind of negotiation to try and get this man out of his vehicle. In the meantime, the terminal was cleared. Boats were still kind of coming and going at that point, so everybody was cleared. They eventually got him out of his vehicle kind of without incident. No one ended up being hurt. They did find an AR-15 style rifle in his vehicle with a can of gas as well as a bunch of wood pellets. No explosives were found at the Steamship Authority terminal or at his vehicle, but it definitely was kind of a jolt in the night for a lot of people.
Sounds like the response was swift, and it took a little while to defuse the situation. What's the takeaway? Where's Mr. Capato now?
He's being held. He had his arraignment on Thursday morning. Not guilty plea was entered on his behalf. He was ordered held without bail. He was being held, I believe, at the Dukes County Correctional Facility over here in Edgartown. We've learned a little bit about him. He supposedly had a body cam on during this whole situation. He told people he threatened to kind of vaporize officers or anybody who kind of came near his vehicle. So we're still kind of unwinding exactly what was going on, kind of his motivation, and kind of anything else, that happened here. But, due to be back in court on Tuesday, so we might hear more about it.
And grateful to all the folks who were involved who helped to defuse that situation with nobody getting hurt.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about a different story. A little earlier, we heard from Eve Zuckoff about the decision this week by the feds to withdraw proposed speed vessel restrictions. These were intended to protect whales, but people on the vineyard had strong feelings here, most in opposition. Tell us how this played out on the vineyard a little bit.
Yeah, on the vineyard, as you can imagine, the thought of losing more ferry service really alarmed a lot of people. And kind of the kind of overarching message a lot of people, both from the Steamship Authority and kind of public officials here on the island, was, yes, we want to help whales. We think whales are important, but we don't think that this rule would really help them all that much. The idea of ferry captain said, you know, we've never seen kind of ferry whales as we're going along here. We kind of make this crossing, you know, dozens of times a day. So they kind of thought, you know, this is going to be pain without any real payoff, was kind of the idea on the vineyard and with the Steamship Authority.
And vineyard officials worked to make that message clear. It seems like at the federal level, at some point, some version of this message was heard.
Yeah, Bob Davis, the general manager of the Steamship Authority, went down to talk to people in Washington. Bill Keating has kind of been quarterbacking this issue. He's been kind of stumping on it, talking to the folks who were kind of looking at this in the final review down in Washington. The High Line and C Street ferries were also very against it, largely because their whole ferry system is fast ferries. And that could have really thrown their business model in disarray. So it definitely seemed like in our area, there was a pretty unified voice. Obviously, a lot of scientists were still concerned and said, you know, this kind of reducing this whole thing kind of coastwide is maybe misguided. But that was kind of the feeling out here is, you know, you could really cripple the economy and really harm people's ways, even down to, you know, high school sports and medical appointments trying to get to the mainland.
It's Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Ethan, thanks for joining us.
Yep. Thank you, Steve.
Pride Month, which comes in June, typically gets a lot of attention and support on the Outer Cape. But Orleans on the Lower Cape is looking to expand that perception and putting some plans in place. Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to explain. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
Here we are in January. Just tell us, why are we talking about this now? And what is Orleans working on here?
Yeah, it's a good question. But truthfully, at least the thought of, you know, doing a Pride Month celebration in Orleans goes really as far back as the summer. So really, there's been some talk among the people who are organizing it going back already a few months. There was a kickoff meeting kind of held by Zoom in December that got enough sort of buy-in or participation that really convinced organizers that this was worth kind of pursuing further. But Rick Francolini, who's an Orleans resident, he and his wife Joan and a few others are really the ones spearheading this. You know, Rick was before the select board last week, and he talked about, you know, his daughter, who is bisexual, and she's engaged to someone who's transgender. So this is an issue that, you know, kind of has some personal resonance for him. And, you know, he's was talking about how he's learned so much about sort of gay and LGBTQ and trans culture, you know, through his daughter, through her partner. And that was really the incentive to kind of do something to really just, you know, celebrate, you know, that facet of the community and kind of, you know, work toward, you know, more inclusion on the lower Cape.
So he was before the select board talking about the plans that are starting to shape up for this. What are they discussing? What are they proposing?
Yeah, well, the cornerstone sort of event would be a parade that would be held. They're looking at the weekend of June 13th. So Saturday, June 14th, they want to hold a parade. Not anything on the scale of what we've, you know, the kind of events we typically see in Provincetown, but, you know, something small. They something akin to, you know, Orleans has a holiday stroll. You know, they want to do something kind of along the same lines as that. Nothing too big, but, you know, something that certainly, you know, again, brings more awareness, brings more recognition to, you know, the LGBTQ community, you know, further out in the Cape, because the recognition is the idea is, you know, these are issues that need to be celebrated and recognized more broadly across the region. Beyond the parade, there's also a day of programming that's being coordinated. They're looking at the Cape Rep Theater in Brewster to host those events that could include, you know, panel discussions, music, poetry readings, things of that nature. So it's really a grab bag of different things that they're trying to bring together over the course of the weekend.
And how's the town's response? What was the select board response here?
Yeah, unanimously across the board, there was support for it. I think it really just comes down to, you know, logistics. You know, anytime you're planning an event, especially in the summer, there's a lot of coordination involved, you know, certainly on the public safety standpoint and police, fire, things like that. You know, this is something that's going to be done at no cost to the town. The organizers are going to, you know, privately fundraise and kind of pull together the money they need to do this. But the town certainly has thrown, you know, its support behind the event. And it's really just more going forward about just working out, again, the logistics about how this is all going to come together.
The town, it sounds like they focus on a couple aspects here. One of them is the community building aspect of this and the welcoming aspect of it. But there's also an economic component that they seem quite open to as well.
Yeah, certainly. I think anytime you bring, you know, an event on the scale of like a parade or something like that to town, there's certainly a trickle down, you know, effect on the community. I think the towns always have kind of an eye on that broader kind of community impact when they host these things. But yeah, it was discussed that, you know, if you have an event like a parade that sort of comes through downtown, that'll cause people to maybe spend the day in Orleans. And there could be some sort of economic trickle down there to different shops and the local restaurants and things like that. So, you know, again, the main priority is sort of celebrating, you know, gay culture, LGBTQ. But certainly, yeah, they're very mindful of the fact that if you bring people in, there could certainly be some economic benefit to be derived as well.
And this may be just the first of a series going forward.
Yeah, that's the hope. I think right now they're looking at this year. You know, it's, you don't want to go cart before the horse too much. You want to make sure, you know, this event goes off as well as it can. But I certainly think that that's the vision, that this is something that could be, you know, held annually. And, you know, Rick was talking about, you know, the importance of bringing these events into small towns. You know, that's really the key to sort of, you know, normalizing the things we hear so much about, you know, trans rights and LGBTQ culture. You know, get them into the communities, get them into the towns, and hopefully that's the way to just get, you know, more recognition and celebration.
It's Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Ryan, thank you.
All right, thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. The next story we're going to talk about appeared in the Provincetown Independent. It's kind of a zoning story, but let me just read from the beginning to set it up. It starts, "If Commercial Street is Provincetown's unforgettable face and Bradford Street its beating heart, then Shank Painter Road would be a body part, rather less glamorous, the digestive system perhaps, essential but not beautiful." Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, who wrote that fine description, joins us to explain how Provincetown is attempting to re-envision this much-overlooked thoroughfare. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
Shank Painter Road, as it exists now, is kind of, it's quite strange in that the asphalt roadway seems to flow kind of unimpeded around a number of the businesses as you drive down it. It's all kind of continuous. Can you describe it a little bit more as it is now so we can understand what they're looking to transform?
Sure. Shank Painter Road has a lot of really important businesses, including a gas station, the grocery store, the laundromat, a couple of banks, a lot of our affordable housing. It also just has these massive parking lots that open straight into the street, you know, without any real division. So there are stretches that just feel like you're driving through an enormous parking lot. Most of it doesn't have sidewalks or bike lanes. For a pedestrian, there's cars sort of zooming on all sides of you, even if you're in the correct part of the margin of the road, because there's so much parking to your other side. So it really isn't a safe place to walk because of the speed at which people are exiting these parking lots. And that's one of the things that they're hoping to fix here.
So talk about the plan in its most basic form. They're looking to change the character of the entire street, really.
Yes. And it's interesting because zoning usually is all about maximums, like trying to stop you from doing too much. Mm. And this is really about trying to stop you from doing too little. They want to see bigger buildings much closer to the road. They want to not have parking in front. Parking has to be in the back. They want to limit the driveways to a pretty narrow opening and have the front be active uses, so outdoor dining or retail or barbershops, art galleries, even art studios, but with big windows so you can kind of see in and see what's happening, things that are interesting to pedestrians and that also have the effect of slowing down drivers. One of the big pushes here is that these tall buildings close to the road have the effect of slowing down motor traffic along with making it nicer for pedestrians.
And when we say tall buildings, you're talking about three-story buildings close to the road, maybe four-story buildings a little bit further back. Is that right?
Exactly, which is big for Cape Cod. You know, we don't have a lot of three- and four-story buildings. So the Provincetown already upzoned for that fourth story several years ago. If you're making a housing project and you sixth of it is affordable, then you're entitled to that fourth story. But this is expanding on that and asking for multiple buildings. There's some really big lots on Shank Painter. So they're zoning for multiple buildings, several of which will be really close to the street with these more engaging uses in them.
And so people are clear, what the town is saying is not that this has to happen right now, but it's really laying the framework so that in future, if and when these properties are sold and redeveloped, there's a guideline in place that brings them closer to what this ultimate vision could be. Is that right?
Yes. This unfolds over decades. I mean, Provincetown's last really big rezoning was in the late 80s. So when you're setting these guidelines, you know that they don't happen right away. No current owner has to do anything different. It is frequently when owners sell, the next owner has a vision, and that vision will be shaped by what these new rules are, which is we want to see this kind of building in this kind of position, and we want to see mixed use with some commercial on the ground floor at a minimum and residential around it.
How's all this being received?
You know, Schenck Painter, as it is now, is so discouraging. Mm. I think people are very open to change because it is Provincetown's least attractive body part, to stick with that metaphor. It's important, and it is one of the main access points to town. And also, you know, we have really significant housing needs here, and trying to integrate large buildings into the many small side streets of Provincetown isn't easy. The lot sizes are tiny. You'd have to accumulate all of these parcels and connect them to try to build an apartment building. So this being some of the last large lots in town, I think people are really eager to see some bigger transformative projects that can make a dent in the housing crisis happen in this neighborhood.
In your story, you point to a couple of these lots that are kind of at play that could really contribute to making an impact in the housing situation.
Yes, there are some town-owned parcels that already have some big plans coming. 65 units being built now, another 40. They're going to be below-market condos where the old police station used to be. But there's also a lot of private lots I didn't list in that story. You know, the self-storage property just went up for sale. It says redevelopment opportunity, really big on the billboard. So if someone comes and tears that down and wants to build something new, there are several other parcels that are really underbuilt. Lots of parking surrounding, you know, a 20-seat restaurant or a nightclub that closed 20 years ago. So there's some big parcels that could turn over. Again, it doesn't happen fast. You never know when those things happen. But the zoning would be in place so that when it happens, you can see something dramatically different.
How far away are they from locking in the zoning?
They're talking about town meeting in April. Mm. So there's a few planning board hearings that have to happen, but pretty soon. Mm.
People can see pictures of the proposed kind of streetscape, what it might look like, at the website. That's Provincetown Independent. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Earlier, we heard some about the decision to scrap the vessel speed reduction proposals and what that could mean for the Vineyard. Nantucket has been watching those rules carefully, too. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror has more details from the island, joins us now. Hiya, Josh.
Good morning.
Very close to the top of your piece on this, you have a quote from Representative Bill Keating that seems to ring with some of the sentiment on the island about what they didn't do. Tell us, kind of paraphrase what that was and what the impact has been on the island about this.
Right. The impact, to start with, has been very positive so far. Again, it's only been out for about 24 to 48 hours, but it was the proposal to restrict vessel speed limits for a good chunk of the year in Nantucket Sound and up and down the eastern seaboard was very concerning out here on Nantucket. The town commissioned an independent consultant to do a survey, an economic survey, that estimated that nearly $300 million of the economy would be impacted if the vessels were not allowed, the steamship and highline vessels were not allowed to travel the way they currently do. And that would obviously have a huge impact, huge effect on the island's economy, both the year-round economy and the tourism and seasonal economy. So town officials in particular are very happy right now. Select Board Chair Brooke Moore, who had been advocating on behalf of the town for a carve-out for Nantucket Sound, which would have benefited Martha's Vineyard as well, based on the detrimental effects that restrictions could potentially have, said, you know, obviously she's just as happy that, you know, the withdrawal achieves the same result, and now islanders, visitors, and businesses no longer have to worry, at least for now, about drastic changes in ferry service.
Mm. And what Keating said was that some of the best decisions are the ones that aren't made. And in his view, this fell into that category as they withdrew the rules that they were proposing. It's interesting that the island was really advocating for this exemption for Nantucket, which seemed to make a lot of sense considering that there haven't been a lot of sightings of these whales or any sightings that we know of.
Exactly. There have been, according to the Steamship Authority and local fishermen, there have been zero sightings of North Atlantic right whales, not just in the shipping lane, but anywhere in Nantucket Sound. In decades, if not centuries. So it was a little confusing to people out here on the islands and on the Cape as well, as to, you know, sort of the width and breadth of this restriction and why it applied to Nantucket Sound, specifically because of that, but also because there are other areas, Buzzards Bay and other areas up and down the eastern seaboard, that had already been exempted, particularly because of high traffic. Mm-hmm. But when you add, you know, factor in that no right North Atlantic right whales had ever been seen in Nantucket Sound, it just didn't seem to make all that much sense. Proponents of the restriction did say, though, that this was really, you know, a proactive measure, and that, you know, they're not sure, based on, you know, migration trends, that within the next 25 to 50 years, North Atlantic right whales may end up in Nantucket Sound. But, you know, I think town officials and their advocates, for all the way up to Congressman Keating, said, well, let's address that when the time comes. But right now we can't really have a $300 million impact on Nantucket and you know, as high in other communities that would be impacted by this restriction.
Josh, there are a few hot-button issues in our region, issues that really inflame. I want to ask you about one in the news this week. And yes, I am talking about pickleball. The zoning board on the island floated the idea that it was characterized anyway as banning pickleball on the island. Explain what happened here.
Yeah, a far more important story to most islanders, perhaps, than the vessel speed restrictions and a $300 million impact on the economy. Don't take away our pickleball. It was actually the planning board, but... exactly right. They have floated the idea, and I guess you could say are batting around the idea of banning pickleball courts island-wide following a recent spate of noise complaints in residential areas. The idea, in the form of a draft zoning bylaw that is going to go before the voters at May's annual town meeting, created quite a pickle at Wednesday's select board meeting. You know, as most people know, no joking, is, you know, at all. Pickleball is one of the fastest-growing recreational sports in the country, and certainly has taken root here on Nantucket as well. Planning Board Chair Dave Iverson was quick to point out, however, that while the potential draft of this article does in fact ban pickleball island-wide, that's not the intent. Despite the fact that it's written that way, it's really about regulating the proliferation of pickleball courts in dense residential districts. Then the current wording is only a starting point that can be reduced, and that's one of the things the Planning Board is going to discuss about it when they meet on Tuesday. But that nuance wasn't really made clear at Wednesday's board meeting, nor was the fact that existing pickleball courts would not be affected if any regulations approved at town meeting. So for advocates of the sport, several of whom showed up at the select board meeting, the threat of an island-wide ban led to some immediate pushback.
That is Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, where you can read all about it. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Towns on the South Coast are taking a closer look at their drinking water, concerned about levels of PFAS contamination. Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light joins us now with the story. Hi, Adam.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Adam, we know PFAS is a concern for many towns across the region. Taking a look at the wide picture to start, how does it seem the South Coast is doing and when it comes to the potential PFAS contamination?
Certainly, Steve. And as you noted, I mean, potential PFAS contamination, we're still in the early stages of sampling. It's really only been going into full force and for public water systems since 2020, or specific testing anyway. There have been monitoring under the unregulated contaminant rule, but point being is that, you know, early signs show that there are many public water systems on the South Coast so far that seem to be safe from, you know, potentially, you know, harmful levels of contamination as determined by, you know, new EPA standards. There are three major public water systems on the South Coast that may be dealing with levels of PFAS that are above EPA standards. These standards are very strict. They went into place in 2024. But I mean, while it's not as pervasive as in, you know, some other parts of Massachusetts and across the country, I mean, there are certainly water systems that are being affected and, you know, taking action to, you know, look into solutions for potential contamination.
For anybody kind of just joining this conversation in midstream, explain what PFAS are and how they get into the water and why we're concerned about them.
Certainly. So PFAS are a family of chemicals used in manufacturing dating back to, you know, roughly the 1950s. They're used to make, you know, nonstick or, you know, water-resistant products like raincoats, nonstick pans, mascaras. They're really found in many consumer goods. And what's great about them is they have a fluorine-based bond that allows them to, you know, stay strong forever. You know, so that they've earned the nickname Forever Chemicals because they take years to break down. And, you know, in recent years, I mean, industry has known that they can be harmful to human health. They weren't very forthcoming about the information. So scientists and regulators have started studying them and found links to all sorts of illnesses, including cancers, birth defects, issues with immune system function and liver and kidney disease. So, you know, harmful things, you know, highly toxic, measured in the parts per trillion. And it's really these first EPA regulations that went into place last year, the first ones ever implemented on these chemicals. So it's very much an emerging and evolving situation, and the science is developing rapidly.
Let me just sort of point to one town and ask you what they're looking at there. Westport, what's happening there?
So Westport is a unique case because there's no real public water system or, you know, communal public water system in town. It's made up of a bunch of small public water systems that serve, you know, anywhere from a couple dozen to a couple hundred people, and private wells. So private wells are unregulated by the state, though Westport's had done some testing that's shown that there are some wells that have PFAS above state and EPA standards. And some of these small public water systems are also above these new EPA standards. So Westport's acting on this in a couple of ways, which is one, they're looking to, you know, connect towns to public water by expanding Fall River's water system, which is unaffected by PFAS contamination at, you know, concerning levels into town. And another way is that a lot of small, you know, well owners are looking into installing treatment, which can be expensive. And there's many media, you know, that have to be discarded after they've been contaminated with PFAS during treatment. And there are many concerns over that. So, you know, it's all still developing.
And cost must be a factor for all of these towns that are wrestling with this, that have to upgrade their drinking water systems.
Absolutely, absolutely. The cost of, you know, remediating PFAS can be anywhere from hundreds of thousands to, you know, billions or tens of millions of dollars, and especially to install granulated activated carbon treatments or filtration systems. So it's certainly something that, you know, public water system operators are concerned about, especially given many of them say that they didn't cause the contamination. This came from, you know, sources like landfills or potentially biosolids for fertilizer or industrial discharges of PFAS. So there's many, what they say is the onus is it shouldn't be on the ratepayers and them to, you know, fix these problems that, you know, other parties caused.
Can you, we have just about a minute left, but I do want to ask you about the regulations, because there's kind of a layered approach here. The state has a set of regulations. The EPA, the federal government, has set its own standards for what's permissible. Can you kind of explain how these overlap?
Sure. So, yeah, the state set their own standards for regulations for PFAS back in 2020, essentially regulating a combination of six PFAS and at a total of 20 parts per trillion. That was the limit. If you went over that, then, you know, that would require treatment, et cetera. Whereas the EPA last year issued its first national drinking water standards for PFAS ever, setting the limits for two PFAS, PFOA and PFOS, at 4 parts per trillion, and then a limit for several others closer to 10 parts per trillion. And the point being is these standards are very low. EPA has never had, you know, standards this low for water systems. So it really requires large investments to figure out. And the state will be bringing its standards in line with the EPA's in approximately a year. So it's ultimately the federal government is going to have a rule on this. There's been discussion and, you know, rumors going around of, you know, the impacts of a potential Trump presidency on, you know, some of these rules, whether they will be loosened or, you know, revisited in coming years. But yeah, it's certainly, there's certainly a sticking point, and, you know, public water systems are concerned, especially with the rate the science is developing.
It's Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light. Adam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good one.
That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Eve Zukoff and Jeanette Barnes, Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Adam Goldstein there of the New Bedford Light. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. Nothing goes out over the air that isn't improved by his touch. His ears are a national treasure. Thanks, Dan. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week. We'll